what happened to me 9 months out of law school, I became a millionaire. I literally reaffirmed that money bought love and happiness.
Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of I'm Made for More podcast. It's your host Ennis here, and today's guest is on a mission to empower 1 billion people to be happy. He's the one and only David Meltzer. David's story is so fascinating because it is filled with ups and downs. Growing up with a single mom who made $17,000 a year as a school teacher, there wasn't much to go around for David and his 5 siblings. But despite his circumstances, he took full control of his destiny and became a millionaire only 9 months out of college. And by age 32, he was the CEO of Samsung's smartphone division and was responsible for the first smartphone launch in history. A few years later, David stepped down as CEO and by age 37 found his $120 million empire bankrupt as a result of hanging around the wrong people and making wrong decisions. Nonetheless, he bounced back, and today, David is the co-founder of Sports One Marketing, a sports marketing firm he co-founded with NFL Hall of Fame quarterback Warren Moon. He's also an international keynote speaker, a best-selling author, and host of a top podcast, The Playbook. In this interview, David and I will talk about his philosophy on life, how you can reach your full potential, as well as how to avoid the dummy tax. Now, without further ado, enjoy this powerful interview with none other than David Meltzer.
Dave, thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me. It's a great honor. I love doing these. Just want to empower over 1,000 people to be happy, and this is the best way to do it.
Absolutely. So Dave, at what point in your career, going back to your mission of empowering, you know, people to be happy, at what point in your career did you decide that that was going to be your life's mission?
You know, it happened a few years ago that that would be my life mission. Before, it was more specific. You know, for over 20 years, I've been doing free trainings every Friday to help people with 3 things. To make a lot of money. So I did sales trainings and all types of business advisory and coaching and mentoring to help people. So I got people involved in charities and causes, and I acquired both at Lee Steinberg, the most notable sports agency in the world, which I ran, and Sports One Marketing, where I co-founded that with Warren Moon. We set out to specifically make sure that everybody that did business with us on any of the aspects that we did business had a charitable purpose or cause that they were tied to. And then, of course, to have a lot of fun. So that was the fun part, was to be happy. Well, that was always kind of a third of the objective until a few years ago when my then 12-year-old daughter, she's now 16, had a friend who committed suicide. And it rocked me. I can understand why people commit suicide. I understand mental illness. I understand drug and alcohol addiction. I understand depression. But 12-year-olds, at an extraordinary amount, something was a matter. We had lost perspective of why we were here. And it was no longer about just making money and helping people. It now was really about, how do I teach people to be happy? How do I teach people to empower other people? How can I create a collective consciousness of happiness that will create abundance so that more people make more than enough, that more people make a ton of money to help a ton of people? So instead of focusing in on these 3 different silos in which I effectuated over a world of people that live in as victims in a world where things are happening to them, which more and more people today feel like victims. They feel like, why me? Everything's happening to me, the pandemic, the politics, the profits, whatever it may be. Or then the people that were more like me living in a world of just enough, you know, people who buy so many things to be happy, buy different things to be happy, buy more things to be happy. They buy things to impress people to be happy. They buy things to impress people they don't even like to be happy. And when you aggregate all those people, they live in a world of just enough for them.
I love it. So what does happiness mean to you, and how did that change from when you were maybe a teenager to now?
Well, originally, until I was about 30-some years old, money bought happiness and love. And everything I did in my life at a young age, since the time I was 5, was gauged to making money, which did have one great positive to it is that when you are looking to make money to be happy, there's always more money to be made and there's always more opportunities. So you never lock yourself in. You don't go through life, you know, doctor, lawyer, failure with blinders on. You have blinders open looking for how can I make more money? How can I make more money? But what happened to me 9 months out of law school, I became a millionaire. I literally reaffirmed that money bought love and happiness. And then we sold that company for $3.4 billion and money reaffirmed itself as happiness. And then I went to the Silicon Valley, raised hundreds of million dollars, more reaffirmation. Then I married my dream girl from the fourth grade and made even more money being the CEO of the first smartphone company for Samsung and Microsoft, the PCE phone. And that just reaffirmed more. So that's where I started, Money Buys Love and Happiness. What I learned, because I had lost my gratitude, my forgiveness, my accountability and inspiration, what I learned by buying things I didn't need, more things I didn't need to impress people I didn't like, what I learned was money doesn't buy happiness and love. What buys happiness is the ability to shop. And money is one of the variables that allows us to shop. So money still became important, which is the guise of my three, you know, happiness statements, make a lot of money to help a lot of people and have a lot of fun. That became just to be happy. And my new definition of happiness is not money buys happiness and love, not money allows you to shop, so it buys you happiness and love. It's simply enjoy, be happy with the consistent every day, persistent without quit, pursuit of your own potential. So don't vote for what your parents want, your relative wants. Don't vote for what you're missing in your life. You'll get what you're missing. Don't for what you don't want in your life. You'll get what you don't want. But if you can vote for what you want and you can, you know, literally see and perceive it, you will enjoy the consistent, persistent pursuit of what you want and it will come more rapidly and accurately.
I totally agree with that, Dave. Kind of taking a step back, I know you were born in Akron, right? You were born in actually the same hospital as LeBron James and Steph Curry. What the hell did they give you guys? Because I want some of it, first of all. But then your mom moved you to San Diego with your five siblings. What was it like growing up with a single mom and five siblings?
So, you know, for me, everything was extraordinarily empowering because my mom had such principles. You know, she wasn't perfect, right? My mom was your typical Jewish mom. So it was doctor, lawyer, failure. I always say she was a third degree black belt in the martial art of Jewish guilt. You know, like she woke us all up at 5 a.m. But there was so much love and happiness in my childhood, just not a lot of money. So that's why I got focused, laser focused on making money because it was the only thing missing from my life. And I felt, gosh, the only time my mom is crying, the only time she's scared, frustrated, angry, or a bad mom is when, you know, something happens that we can't afford, a car fixed or food or summer camp or, you know, financial distress. And it would eat me alive because I only knew so much of my mom. She was so incredible. All I want to do is to give her everything she deserved because she had given me such an extraordinary life. And I still feel that way. And so for me to be inspired to do that for my mom, to buy her a house and a car, was an incredible way to grow up.
Totally. If you and I were like buddies back in high school, say we're like 15, 16, would I bet on you to be like who you are today and reach the success that you've reached?
Yeah, I think at 15, my friends would have bet on either Dave Meltzer is going to be, at then a millionaire was a big deal when I was 15. They weren't any billionaires. Yeah. I think people would either say, yeah, Dave Meltzer is going to be a millionaire or he's going to be broke. There's no in between.
Really?
So it's like the total extremes.
Yeah, for sure.
Interesting.
Okay. And guess what? They both were right.
That's right. Yeah, you're living proof of that for sure. All right, so fast forward to college. You went to Tulane and you studied to become a lawyer like you mentioned earlier. And after graduation, you were offered two jobs, right? One was to be an oil and gas litigator and it was paying well. It was going to be a six-figure job. And the other was to sell legal research on the internet, which was, you know, nobody knew what the internet was back then. How did you know that being a litigator wasn't going to be your destiny and that you should follow your dream?
You know, for me, I kind of take a different perspective of following my dream Because I always say that if I focused in on learning to love what I did, then I wouldn't have to worry about what I was doing. And if my goal was to make as much money from what I did, I would enjoy it that much more. So I used to sit on my bed in law school and tell God, hey, I'll shovel shit with my hands 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, if you let me buy my mom a house and a car, and I'll be super grateful and happy doing it, no problem. So I practiced and learned that perspective, that mindset. Secondly, was just the math. So beyond having the right mindset that I was willing to learn to love what I did, the math for me made sense. You know, let's say that the oil and gas job was 150K, which was a lot of money out of law school. You know, looking at the hours, you know, my dad always had a saying, you know, don't be a lawyer. He had a law degree as well. He said, because, you know, there's only so many hours in a day and you're charging by the hour. So, you know, when I started looking at the hours, I'm like, wait a second, I'm making 50 grand a year. They're just having me work three jobs and calling it one job, right? I'm working three full, you know, 120 hours a week. What are you kidding me? You know, I'm not going to make 50 grand a year. So I took a job that I felt it had a $250,000 comp plan. It had unlimited cap on it when I started. They changed it because I made over $1 million 9 months out of law school, so that it changed my comp plan. But moreover, I went ahead and looked at how much money I could make, did the math, and I also mitigated my risk. I think it's important for people to realize I'm a realist. You know, I it's not like I'm some head up in the sky dreamer without mitigating risk. So the one thing was, I knew that if I became a lawyer, it would be years and years and years before I could be an entrepreneur, before I could go into the internet or some other crazy thing. As my mom said, the internet was a fad, some other fad. But I knew that if I went after the fad first, that I always, because I took the bar, because my mom Jewish guilted me into taking the bar, I passed the bar, I could always go practice law, right? There'd always be some, there wouldn't be a new fad always, or the ability to leave, but I just knew that. And so all of those things together, mitigating risk, understanding the math, and also seeing where I could make the most money, the whole shoveling shits with my hands story, those were the three indicators that I made the right choice, regardless of having to go against my own mother, like I said, that was so against me being a salesperson. You got to be a real lawyer, you know. Well, when I bought her the house and the car, she realized there was many more things than being a lawyer.
I love it, man. All right, so wait, at what point did you realize that you had the knack, you know, for sales?
You know, I always knew I had a sales personality. My dad was an extraordinary salesperson. My grandfather, on my mom's side, was an extraordinary salesperson. So inherently in my genetics and my social upbringing, I watched and witnessed some amazing salespeople in my family. You know, but moreover, in college, while I was playing college football, you know, I was broke. I got a full scholarship to college. I had no money. I went to college, this is a true story, with $212. I took it out of the bank machine when I was leaving for football camp. I was so nervous, I left it in the bank machine. So I went to college with no money, and my mom didn't have the money to give to me. So I literally needed to figure out how I was going to, you know, live beyond the school food and school tuition, you know, like no money. So I took a sales job at nights where you would sell books, encyclopedias, but it was called an educational system. You would sell, you know, for the pre-maternal mom, so she's pregnant, to read books to her stomach. And then there was this new series that came out every year for 1-year-olds, 2-year-olds, 3-year-olds, all the way up to a full set of encyclopedias till they're 18. And it was thousands and thousands of dollars, but at $50 a month. And the way you sold it was saying, hey, you're going to, as much as it's $50 a month, this is your college education savings, right? Way back when, this is in the 80s. Yeah. You know, you invest this. My siblings all went to the Ivy Leagues because my mom read to us, you need the right materials. These are the best book, you know, Dr. Spock and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, those were big sales, 18 years at $50 a month. And I would get two appointments, you know, three nights a week. And, you know, if I could close one or two of those, I was making way more than anyone else.
Wow. And in your book, you talk about how there's like two different salesmen, right? There's the eagle, which you were, which was the natural born. And then there's the journeyman, right? Do you feel like talent beats hard work, or can a journeyman become better than a natural born you know, salesman, which is the ego?
Talent will outperform hard work in a short period of time. Hard work will outlast talent. And if you can combine talent and hard work, now you're talking about the Hall of Fame spirit of excellence. The 1% of the 1% are people who have found their inherent talents and apply journeyman perspective, attitude, and work ethic to it. And I think that's really, I fall more on the journeyman side on a lot of things, but on sales, I'm an eagle. But because like for football, I was a journeyman, I, you know, no talent at all, but I learned the work ethic and consistent, persistent behavior. Because of that, applying it to what I was really good at put me to the highest level very quickly. But you can't get to the highest level on talent alone or on hard work alone. You need to combine the two.
Interesting. Okay, so for someone that doesn't know what their true talent is, right, but they're hardworking, what advice do you have for that person on how they can find their true talent?
Continually develop your skills, continually develop your knowledge of what and who, and continue to grow your inspiration, your desire that you must be what you can be. And many opportunities and options will come up. And the more opportunities and options that you have because you have more capabilities, knowledge, and desire, the better suited you will be to align those capabilities with what's doing well somewhere. And then that will become what you call your innate ego passion, your innate talent. But look, there's multiple talents that people have. They're quantum in your nature. And remember, personality is a practice. So just because a talent may not be activated doesn't mean you don't have it. And the hard work may activate that talent as well that you start finding. You know, like sports, people get too broad and be like, oh, you got no talent for sports because you're never going to be a professional football player. Yeah, but there's many things within sports that I have great talent for. You know, I never thought I'd be, you know, a top podcaster, like a great interviewer. But, you know, people like Katie Kirk and James Brown, I've interviewed them. They've interviewed me. And they're like, oh, my God, how long have you been doing this? You know, this is innate in my being, right? I had no idea. But if I wasn't continually developing my skills, my knowledge, and my desire, I never would have the opportunity to have realized or activated or practiced my personality and find my highest, best suited talents along with the work ethic. Remember, the work ethic will allow you to find the talents. Talents, if you're relying on simply those, you're not going to find new talents just being talented.
Interesting. Very interesting perspective. I'm going to have to go back and listen to what you just said again, because that's, I totally agree. All right, so moving on. I know you recently tweeted, everyone around you knows someone who can help you, or they can help you themselves, right? And in your book, you talk about the concept of avoiding the dummy tax. Can you explain what the dummy tax is and talk about how, you know, building a powerful network has impacted your career?
Yeah, well, I think it revolves around asking. And asking is knowing that in person, on the phone, via email and media, radio, print, TV, and social media, we now have more access to more people than ever imagined. It's unfathomable still today, to me, even, of how big that audience is and how to construct what I want to do within the context of that. And in order to do so, we have to look upon people not as gatekeepers, not as resistance, void, shortages, and obstacles to what we want, but more, like you stated, as sponsors. Everyone out there knows somebody that can help us, or a power sponsor, someone that can help us themselves and know someone that can help us. Remember, when I was your age, most people only knew about five people. They had a golf game, a card game, a church group, something that could introduce you to five people if they really liked you. Well, today, if somebody really likes you and they want to help you as a sponsor or a power sponsor, on average, everybody knows about 1,000 people. So if you're not asking for help, if you're not asking the magic question, do you know anyone that can help me, and also providing service to others, you know, then you're making a huge mistake. And so for you, we need to ask and attract, expand. Now, what's the dummy tax is different. The dummy tax is the ability to find mentorship. You know, the easiest way to get to where you want to go is to ask someone for directions. And people are not asking for directions. They're not asking for help. So what are we doing? If I want to go ahead and figure out something in real estate, I want to find someone that sits in the situation that I want to be in. Why? Because they've already made the mistakes. I don't have to pay the dummy tax. So that dummy tax is the mistakes. to do that.
Totally. I was just reading like an article not too long ago, and it said 76% of people think mentors are important, but only 37% currently have one. And you believe in having three mentors at all times. Why three? And what role should each mentor play? And how do you go about finding a mentor?
Yeah, so you got to take inventory of your own values first. So if you take inventory of your own values, you'll know what you want. Most people know their why, or the why will come behind. They don't know what they want. The minute you know what you want and where you want to go, or what you want, you can find someone who has it. Skills, knowledge, desire, capabilities, energy, yep. Whatever it is. And most people don't take the time to be more interested than interesting and to take inventory of their values. And so the way that I still, because I do, I have mentors and I have a sleep coach. Why? Because I knew how important sleep was, because I did all the research of the conscious, subconscious, and unconscious continuum of figuring out what happens when we're asleep and why we want to plateau and grow when we wake up. We want to live our lives at the highest frequency when we wake up, not wake up at the bottom of a hill as if we had, you know, pushed the boulder to the top of it every day to have it roll down every morning. No. So I learned, hey, I know what I want. I want to learn how to sleep better. And so I went, found someone that's the expert for the NFL and the MLB, Dr. Meeta Singh, and I got her to be my sleep coach because I wanted to be able to plateau and grow. That's the exact methodology you use. And some people will do it for free. Some people will pay for it. If you have to pay for it, understand what the effect will be and what the investment is. You know, for me, sleeping is worth so much. You know, it's unbelievable. You know, to get 2-3 hours of more productivity because I'm sleeping well, and what I make in an hour or two is incredible. So 2 or 3 hours a day, 7 days a week. You know, I don't want to tell Dr. Singh how much money she's made me, but she's the biggest bargain I have.
And speaking of productivity, something else I've heard you talk a lot about is being a student of your calendar, right? And you're running multiple businesses. You've got this huge personal brand. You serve as a board member at multiple companies. You've got the Playbook podcast. You got a family, kids. Basically, everyone wants your time, right? How do you manage your time so effectively, and how do you, you know, prioritize your time?
Yeah, so you got to take inventory of your values, number one, so you know how to make quick decisions. I have rules about visiting time. I plan visiting time. I don't let people waste my time by visiting. So I have a 5-20 rule with phone calls where my objective is 5 minutes for each phone call, 20 minutes for every interview or meeting. Getting and being a student of our calendar, studying is the mathematical equation of luck. It's attention plus intention equals the coincidences in our lives. When we study things, that's what makes them happen. So I use a lens, I call it the Meltzer kaleidoscope, of productivity. How much value am I going to provide? How much accessibility am I going to give to others? And how am I accessing what I want? And of course, the lens of gratitude. I'm utilizing a focus of finding light, love, and lessons in everything I do. And I do that in three aspects in my calendar. What I have planned, utilizing the 5-20 rule. What I don't have planned, the blank space, the empty space, where I can utilize the do it now strategy to do things now that I didn't have planned. And then finally, sleep. Sleep is like exercise to me. It's a 8-hour activity that you have to warm up for the night before. So my tomorrow starts today because I have a warm up to my sleep starting at 9 o'clock. And that warm up is called an unwinding routine that devoids myself of negative energy, stress, interference, so that I can guide myself into the most restful, productive sleep for 8 hours or less in order to plateau and grow tomorrow.
Well, there you have it, guys. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. It would mean so much if you would follow I'm Made for More podcast on Spotify and subscribe and rate on Apple Podcasts. And for more inspiration, be sure to go follow David at David Meltzer. And until the next time, dream big, because you, my friend, are made for more.